is to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, delivered to your earbuds from San Francisco and supported by great listeners, including Raymond Welch, Michelle Pasco, John DeVries, and Andrew Krieger. If you're able and you'd like to help, you can grab a voluntary subscription. Just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and it starts at just $5 a month. In the second segment of today's podcast, we're going to meet Catherine Austin Fitz. She defies categorization. She worked in the first Bush administration in the Housing and Urban Development Department. She is a financial advisor, and in general, she doesn't believe official stories about almost anything. But first, we go to the front lines of the war against the middle class, Madison, Wisconsin, where my friend Aldous Tyler is standing by. A couple of months ago, Aldous was on the program here talking about his intention to launch a progressive challenge in the Democratic primaries to the sitting president, Barack Obama. Aldous, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure.
And tell us how it's been since we talked to you last. I saw a flurry of activity on Facebook. You've got a website up. And you also went to the Fighting Bob Fest, an annual progressive event right there in Madison. Tell me what kind of response you've gotten to your announcement that somebody, and if it's not anybody else, it's going to be Aldous Tyler, somebody ought to challenge Barack Obama from the left.
Well, and it's really interesting, Peter, because since I was on your program last, I looked up, and there are a number of people who have gone to, and I'm talking in the last year, year and a half, who actually did put their hats in the ring wanting to be considered for presidential candidacy on the Democratic ticket. But I went and contacted them because I'm like, oh, wait, are there other people? Because as I told you, it doesn't have to be me. It's not about me. It's about making sure this happens from a progressive angle. And I contacted, and nobody has a live campaign anymore. They're all like, no, never mind. We gave it up. And so I'm like, okay, well, then I proceed. So from there, I went to, as you said, Fighting Bob Fest. Now, just to give you an idea, Fighting Bob Fest has historically gotten over 10,000 of the most active, the heart of the liberal and progressive activist movement comes out every year. We have wonderful guests and speakers there, Senator Bernie Sanders, Tom Hartman, you name them. They come, Jim Hightower, all these guys. Well, because this is like the heart of it, I figured, well, this could be interesting. I figured this would be the make or break. I will find out if I have support or not by how these people, you know, take me. And as it turned out, Peter, I was extremely warmly received to the point where nobody, and I mean, get this, of the hundreds of people I alone talked to, much less all the people, other people who took flyers and buttons from me, of them, not one said anything about that I shouldn't do this or that I should reconsider, even. I mean, not one negative word.
Nobody cited Teddy Kennedy's challenge against Jimmy Carter and blamed him for the loss to Ronald Reagan in 1980?
Not at BobFest. That I've gotten all over Facebook, and I got last night at the Dane Democratic Party, the monthly meeting that I attended. However, it's very funny. No, when you get down to the heart of the liberal and progressive movement, the activists, the ones who brought all of their friends and had all their friends bring all their friends down to the Capitol this February, these people have absolutely no problem with the idea of marrying Obama from the left.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because since you launched this exploratory a couple of months ago, I've found even more reasons to be very concerned about Barack Obama and a need to impress upon him that there are those of us to his political left who are deeply disappointed. And it goes beyond disappointment now, and I want to just cite two recent examples. The execution of an American citizen in Yemen using a drone strike on September 30, the man named Anwar al-Awlaki, who was born in New Mexico and who clearly has advocated violence against the United States, nonetheless remains an American citizen. And I'm deeply concerned at the way a secret process was used with secret people on a secret committee at the White House. We don't know the criteria used to establish who gets placed on this so-called kill or capture list. We don't know of anybody who's been placed on the list who's actually been captured. So it devolves to a kill list. And I'm very uncomfortable with the President of the United States essentially ordering the assassination of an American citizen who has never been charged or tried of a serious crime.
Exactly. There was no due process whatsoever. I mean, it would be a different matter if we're talking about somebody who has been at least charged, and I would hope more than that, but prosecuted and convicted of something that would, let's just even say, in some court of law, be considered worthy of the death penalty. I personally have problems with the death penalty. I'll get into that later, or maybe at another time. But the point is this. This is, as you said, a killing of an American citizen, not just some foreign what's-his-face. This is, which, mind you, to me, human beings are human beings, but this is an American citizen who should have absolute rights to due process in a court of law before any punishment is taken on him, much less the death penalty, in this case, by aerial drone. That's completely reprehensible.
And I don't think we even have a warrant or issued a warrant for his arrest. I mean, we didn't even put a kangaroo tribunal together at Guantanamo to compile and present evidence against this man. We didn't even put him on America's Most Wanted on television and just say, you know, here's the case against him. And when people have pressed the White House for the evidence used against Anwar al-Awlaki, they've been offered a leaked document to Charlie Savage is his name. I'm mixing up my Savages. Charlie Savage is a reporter at the New York Times who says that there was a deep internal debate about this whole process and about the placing of Awlaki's name on this killer capture list. But that is not due process. The idea that there was debate inside the administration, that's not due process. That doesn't offer him any checks or balances on presidential authority. So the other part of this, Aldis, that really troubles me is that we're not hearing any of the Democrats who were willing to stand up to the expansion of presidential power asserted by George W. Bush. None of those people are willing to challenge their president on this very critical long-term issue. And what happens when the next president, whether it's, in 13 months or in 4 years, is a Republican who has a very much darker view of who ought to be killed or captured than even Barack Obama has shown?
Well, and it's hard to say exactly what the view is from the Obama White House. I mean, I'm very grateful for the fact that being a presidential contender against him and having publicly filed, maybe that'll offer me a little protection against a drone. And as much as people know that I've declared opposition, so maybe it'll be a little harder for them to justify such a thing.
Yeah.
But no, seriously, I'm not about to get bond, I'm sure. But the point is that it does actually put it to you. Okay. If you can bomb someone using an unarmed drone who has never been convicted of a crime or charged of any crime at all, and the only thing that precedes it is some hot debate in a closed room in the White House, really, how safe is any American citizen that in some way or another does something to upset any administration, be it this one or any future one, as you said? And no, this is a precedent we cannot allow to stand.
And Aldis, in a recent podcast, Bill Black was on with us. He helped bust the fraudsters in the 1980s who looted America's savings and loans. And these numbers are simple to understand but very stark. In the 1980s, the looting of the savings and loans amounted to roughly $150 billion. 10,000 people were referred for investigation, and more than 1,000 were convicted of felonies. All right, $150 billion, 10,000 suspects, 1,000 convicted.
Right.
In the current mortgage meltdown, we have lost more than $11 trillion. And I do not have a number on the number of referrals, but only 10 people to date have been convicted related to mortgage fraud, and the tab is $11 trillion. Now, the Obama administration is not making a high priority of prosecuting the people who strong-armed the American taxpayer and stole our money. But they have announced here in California a four-jurisdiction team effort to crack down on medical marijuana dispensaries. Now, this is obviously a political ploy, and Obama has figured out he doesn't need votes for California. It's not going to go to any of the potential Republican candidates. So he's going to win votes in deep red states, he hopes. Let's say Mississippi or Alabama, by cracking down on medical pot in California. And I just find this so transparently political and so annoyingly arbitrary on the part of the Obama administration, because they've shown us in the first 2 years they're not interested in prosecuting torture. They're not interested in prosecuting financial crimes. They gave a two-year a suspension on medical marijuana prosecutions, and now they're cracking down with an eye toward next November's election.
Well, absolutely, Peter, but let me tell you this, okay? It goes even deeper than that. Have you heard about the Cardinal Enix story in the State Department?
No.
Okay, all right. TransCanada, as you know, is the company that wants to build the Keystone XL pipelines right through the heartland of America all the way to the Gulf Coast of Texas,
right,
in order to pump this nasty tar sand sludge, this bitumen, through the pipes that is no doubt going to be leaking all through the water supply, and then from the extraction process to when it's burned, releases far more carbon into the atmosphere than any other form of crude oil we can possibly make. This pipeline, which, like I said, it wants to be built and then owned by TransCanada, is being overseen by the State Department. Now, the interesting thing about that is the part of the State Department that's supposed to be overseeing, you know, making sure that this is in the best interests of the American people, is being run by a contractor from TransCanada called Cardno Enix. Cardno Enix has control of the State Department in these portions that are supposed to be vetting this whole process. And because of that, these are the people. Cardno Enix was the ones who put out that State Department report that said, oh, no, it's fine. There are no environmental problems. The same report that Obama himself has referred to at least once and will refer to again when he signs this, saying he doesn't see a problem doing this. Look, it says it's fine. The people who are saying it's fine are the big oil corporations in this case, the one in this case specifically TransCanada that wants to do this. And interestingly enough, do you know who owns 25% of the Alberta tar sands?
I'm just going to guess it's the Koch brothers.
Exactly. So what's going on is that Obama has allowed the State Department to be infiltrated by TransCanada, and in so doing is guaranteeing the Koch brothers billions upon billions more dollars right into their pockets. If that's not sleeping with the enemy, I do not know what is.
Well, thanks for filling me in. I didn't know about the Cardno Enix aspect of this. And what I do know is that over 1,000 people protested at the White House and submitted to arrest in August, and they pointed out that this issue is entirely up to the president. It's not an issue that can be blamed on Republicans and their control of the House and their obstructionism in the Senate. This is entirely up to President Obama, and I'm not very encouraged by the signals we're getting that he's going to come to the right conclusion here. Aldis.
What I'm saying too is that I am honestly at this point this close to accusing the State Department under President Obama of purposefully putting the wolf in charge of the sheep here. I mean, because what's going to happen here is all of the reports are going to come back saying this will be fine, it'll be great, it'll be wonderful for the economy, because it's TransCanada's contractor who's saying it, and then the president will sign off on it, and then all blame goes to, oh, well, we had bad info, I guess. Oh, we were just misinformed. Mm-hmm. No. Deliberately speaking, you knew who was in there. He can't not know. Okay, one thing that I will say, as Barack Obama's opponent, he is not a fool. He is not a moron. He knows what's going on in his own departments, and if he doesn't, then he does not deserve the job.
Aldis Tyler is running for president. Tell us what your current status is, Aldis. Are you about to get on the ballot?
Yes, sir. In fact, the first test of my campaign is pretty much upon us. Right now, I am raising funds to get on the New Hampshire Democratic primary ballot. The window for doing that is October 17th to October 28th. I have to have my money by the 24th so I can get it to them on time. So basically, I've got 12 days from now to raise about another, a little less than $1,000 in order to make sure I am on the ballot. But that's all it takes. Seriously, Peter, it's amazing that it's going to be less than a grand, and I will be on the New Hampshire primary ballot, the first primary in the country.
So tell people how they can support you, Aldis. Where can they go to make a contribution?
They can go to either electtyler.com, which is easy for some people to remember, or they can go to americachangestoday.com, because America Changes Today is my slogan. I don't want to wait for this, and I think there's plenty of other people who agree. America needs to be changing today. So americachangestoday.com or electtyler.com if it's easier. And again, the other way to remember it, too, is my name is Aldis C. Tyler, which spells ACT. A-C-T.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, AmericaChangesToday.com or just electtyler.com.
And so you need about $1,000 to get all the paperwork in and pay your filing fee to get on the ballot in New Hampshire. And you need that by the 24th of October.
That is correct. And in the meantime, I am lining up. I'm currently interviewing and lining up some volunteers in New Hampshire to be my delegates. I need two delegates and two alternates. So I want to make sure to get their info. I also need that by the 24th, because that needs to be named on the form.
Well, Aldis, I support what you're doing. I really think it's important for progressives to send this message to President Obama. And I'm not rolling in the dough these days, but I want to see you get on the ballot and make some noise there in New Hampshire. So I'm going to pledge $100, and I'm going to get that to you by the 24th. And
well, thank you, Peter.
I want to see if some of the people who have been generous enough to support my podcast over the last few years can dig into their pockets and match my contribution or even exceed it. I am a philanthropist without a fortune, Aldis. But some
don't we understand that? Actually, Peter, the thing I'm trying to do with my campaign, and I just want to make sure to get this out there, I am a citizen candidate, and that means that I am not going to be making the millions of dollars that you hear for presidential campaigns. I'll be lucky if I make $1 for every $1,000 that Obama pulls in, but I'm going to make each dollar count. I'm going to put it right to getting on the ballot. I'm going to put it towards making sure that the communication structure that need to be there for online work are there, so that we can effectively get the message out for as little money as possible. I want to make sure that people understand, if you want to see a presidential campaign work without big money being involved, I am your man. This is not a big money campaign. I am a citizen candidate, and I'm going into it straight, as efficiently and effectively as I possibly can.
And you haven't been talking to Herman Cain about the 999, have you?
Just if I could get 9 pizzas with 9 toppings for $9, I could do that.
Aldis, I appreciate what you're doing. You are a great American citizen, and you are speaking for me when you send these important messages challenging Barack Obama from the progressive perspective.
Thank you, Peter, and I am honored to be your voice and representative in this. And if anyone else feels the same way, and I'm sure there are, I've been talking to them plenty of them, all of you, just get on board right now. This is the time we need you, so I can get on the ballot and actually hold Barack Obama to account.
All right, the easy one is Tyler, electtyler.com, electtyler.com, or americachangestoday.com. Aldis Tyler,
exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
The Peter B. Collins Show takes you all over the doggone place, and today, let's visit the Smoky Mountains and the great state of Tennessee.
Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
And now we go to Hickory Valley, Tennessee, where Catherine Austin Fitz joins us today on the Peter B. Collins Show. Are you a Davy Crockett fan?
Yes. Of course.
Green Estate, as far as you can see, is that right?
Yeah, but, you know, the big one here is Elvis. You have to be an Elvis fan or you can't live here.
Well, I am an Elvis fan. But,
uh-huh.
But he didn't do any songs about Tennessee, did he?
I
can't remember any, I'll say that.
I don't remember any off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, I'm delighted to talk with you, and I have been curious about you for a number of years because, on the internet, occasionally I'll see a citation for you from you or a commentary, and people have been talking you up, and you're coming to the Bay Area at the end of October.
Uh-huh.
And so I took the opportunity to dial you up and chat with you and want to talk about a number of issues. First, let's define who you are. You have an MBA from the Wharton School. You worked on Wall Street in the 1970s and 80s, rising to senior vice president and also a member of the board of directors of Dillon Reed and Company.
Yeah.
You also were appointed by Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And since then, you've been working in the securities industry. And you are the founder and president of Solari Incorporated and Solari Investment Advisory Services. Now, I'll ask you a little bit about that later in the conversation here, and we'll give people the details on your event in the San Francisco Bay Area in Mill Valley on October 27th. But I wanted to start off because in preparation for this, I did some oogling and googling, and you issued some rather dire predictions about the housing bubble that did burst in 2008. Take a moment here to explain to our listeners what you base that on, and then pat yourself on the back just how damn right you were.
Well, I can't say that I'm very smart for having known it. I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and then a couple years after I left, my company, Hamilton Securities, was hired back on competitive bid to serve as the lead financial advisor for the Federal Housing Administration. And essentially, Peter, what had to happen was if you wanted to have a housing bubble, you had to change all of the rules in Washington related to housing, particularly as to federal credit, because a lot of the housing, the mortgage market, is directly or indirectly guaranteed by the federal government, and particularly because so much is being securitized between Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginny Mae. So what happened was literally you saw the very... a lot of the honest people kicked out, and the terms and conditions changed in a way that literally what happened was a fait accompli. I mean, the fraud was unbelievable. It was just off the charts, and it was very interesting for me because I started to warn people in 99 and kept warning them and kept warning them. One, I was amazed at how long the bubble went because it really speaks to the extent of the fraud. And the second thing was, what was amazing to me is, and this was global because I spoke in New Zealand and Sweden and London, you know, the sort of the feeling globally was that the central bankers are going to make good on this stuff. So it's a little bit like trading sardines. As long as the central bankers are there, you don't need to care whether there's anything real or not. Because what I was saying was we saw lots of instances where, there were far more mortgages created in a town than there were people or houses.
Mm-hmm.
So the fraud was very extensive, and I think it was one of the things I'll say, it was very, very hard for most people to fathom that the fraud was as bad as I was saying it was. I mean, because you're literally talking about trillions of dollars of fraud and a scheme engineered by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve Bank, particularly the New York Fed, to engage in what is essentially massive securities fraud. So it was hard for most people to fathom that it was really that bad.
Well, I agree with your assertion there of this massive fraud, yet the Obama's administration's whole looking forward, not backward mantra troubles me, not only when it comes to crimes like torture and the violation of our constitutional rights with the wiretapping program that continues unabated, but the financiopaths who took our country to the brink of economic ruin until we bailed out their bad bets. It's just stunning that there has been so little effort by this administration to investigate and prosecute wrongdoers. And last week in a podcast that most of my listeners have heard, Bill Black, who was one of the savings and loan regulators who brought to justice 1,000 individuals who were convicted of felonies related to the looting of savings and loans in the 1980s, which produced a loss of a mere $150 billion or so to the U.S. economy. So $150 billion, 1,000 felony convictions, there were 10,000 referrals of potential criminal behavior. In this episode, the Wall Street losses so far are estimated by Bill Black at $11 trillion, and he can only find 10 felony convictions to date. And he faults the referral process. They are not referring cases for investigation by the SEC or FBI, and therefore there are no cases to prosecute.
Well, but I think Bill Black is a very astute, competent guy, so I almost always agree with almost everything he says.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I think it's pretty important to understand is that the financial fraud of the last decade was a success. In other words, the policy that you use to change a failed policy is different than one that succeeded. So the goal of the, I call it a financial coup d'etat, was to basically, I mean, what we saw was a great deal of debt was issued that was including fraudulent debt. And that money was then used to sort of buy up the country. And then when the debt crashed, the country was engineered to pay back. You know, think of this as a leveraged buyout of a country, in fact, of a planet. And so, you know, the people who engineered this were rewarded. They were given bonuses.
Yeah.
And Obama appointed into his administration the people who did it. So, of course, they're not going to promote policies that penalize them for succeeding at what they were asked to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have as an air cover the theory, we're given a false reality. Okay, here's the official story. So, for example, the official story is the war on drugs is designed to stop drug dealing. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, if anything, it enhances the profitability of the illegal narcotics. And so, you know, and then we sit here for 30 years and we say it's failed. Well, no, it succeeded in what it was designed to do, and it's so important for all your listeners to sit back and understand that if we get caught in the spiral down of talking about why this doesn't fit with the official reality and why this is wrong, well, yes, it's wrong, but it was the goal. In other words, these people stole $11 trillion, and they got paid handsomely to do it, and that's what's happened.
Well, and they socialized the losses so that we had to bail them out, or our government felt compelled to. I didn't. it brought out the market fundamentalist in me, and I'm not a free marketer, Catherine, but, you know, bankruptcy is the solution to insolvent business operations.
Right.
And that's what should have happened on a fairly large scale there. But we were told we couldn't allow that. It would crater the whole economy. And so they did succeed. They got away with it, white-collar and red-handed. Uh-huh. And we're doing absolutely nothing to even claw back the ill-gotten bonuses that they made on loans or deals, as Senator Levin has so aptly put it, that were shitty deals.
Okay, so let's talk about how we get power. Because the issue here, we're not living in a society where the federal government or Wall Street obey the laws. Okay, so passing more laws won't help, because they'll simply ignore those laws too, and you know, and then we'll have more laws we have to comply with. So the question is, how do we get power? Now, let me step back to the 90s when this all started.
Okay.
I left the Bush administration, and I said, you know, the fascists are going to kill us all. We need a plan. So I started a company, and one of the things we did was we built a software tool called Community Wizard. That had, we built databases of how all government money, starting with the federal government, and then we were moving into state and local, worked at a county level. Because America just breaks down into 3,100 counties.
Mm-hmm.
And what we discovered, Peter, is that all the government investment, if you just look at the federal government money in a place, has what I call a negative return on investment. And the reason it has a negative return on investment is because it's subsidizing a whole variety of people for political reasons that have nothing to do with any kind of sound economic policy. It's the absence of markets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am a free marketeer, but I've never seen free markets in my lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lovely concept.
Right, what did Gandhi say about Western civilization? I say the same thing about free markets. Anyway, so, but here's what I discovered. Let me give you a couple examples because it helps. One of my big bugaboos is I started a data servicing company that was designed to swing data servicing through telecommunications into neighborhoods that had high unemployment rates. Because when the welfare bill passed, we said, oh, you know, we're gonna kick all these people off of welfare. Well, let's just swing in jobs. And interestingly enough, on the welfare bill, we predicted that there was going to be $6 billion of increased data servicing needs by the federal government just coming out of that bill.
Mm-hmm.
So my attitude was, hey, we don't have to swing data servicing, you know, around the world. We can ship it into the neighborhoods where we have high unemployment. And our analysis showed that if you looked at the money we were paying for people to not work or get food stamps or housing subsidies, in fact, it was you would save, you know, if you pay $55,000 a year for a woman in Washington with 1.8 kids to be in HUD housing subsidized with food stamps and welfare, you know, if she can do a data servicing job for $25,000 a year plus health care, you know, everybody wins.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so we got into this. Well, fast forward to today, if you are in 37 states in this country, including Tennessee, where I live, and you're on food stamps and you call your customer service number if you have a problem,
mm-hmm.
you get J.P. Morgan Chase in India doing the servicing. Now, those are jobs, Peter, those are jobs that you could do in the United States. So we're paying people to not work when they could be doing jobs that we're giving to J.P. Morgan Chase to do offshore. Now, that is financially insane. It's a lose-lose for the tax. It's lose-lose for everybody.
Yeah.
It costs a great deal more money to outsource it to J.P. Morgan, but J.P. Morgan gets a pop on their stock, right? Because the stock trades as a multiple of earnings. So mm-hmm. if you just keep engineering, you know, fixed contracts into these big companies, you basically support their stock. And it's capital gains both on stock and real estate, which is the big source of political contributions. So around and around you go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to get down, if anybody in any county were to get down and look at sources and uses, give you another example. I used to always find, when we were a financial advisor to HUD, I used to always find neighborhoods where we were spending $250,000 per unit to construct public housing when $50,000 to $100,000 would buy and rehab a single-family foreclosed home. So in the Clinton administration, I tried to get this changed in both the Bush and Clinton administration, failed in both. In the Clinton administration, I went to the woman who was the assistant, the person who ran the $250,000 per unit program, and I said, Mindy, you know, if we just optimize within a four-block area, we can get four homes for the price of one. She turned bright red and said to me, but how would we generate fees for our friends? Okay, so where's
and,
the power
and
in this?
Let me ask you about this,
yeah?
Because one of the ideas that I have for the current mess that we have is that we need a new Homestead Act, and we have millions of units of foreclosed and largely unoccupied properties in this country. They're a blight on their neighborhood. They're driving down property values in the community. And we have a lot of people who would love to be in those homes, including people who used to live there before the bank kicked them out.
Right.
And I think we ought to come up with a plan to let people earn equity by living in an unoccupied property for some period of time, and then it converts to a 30-year mortgage or something like that.
Absolutely.
And yet we see no initiative to deal with this, and California is experiencing a new wave of foreclosures. More than 500,000 have occurred or are scheduled to occur in this third quarter of 2011.
Okay, so let me tell you how we get this. We ought to call them the Peter B. Collins Real Estate Trusts. Okay, so in 1989, I became FHA commissioner, and we had 50,000 foreclosed homes around the country. And it turned out that there was a town in New Mexico, Peter, where 70% of the homes, of the mortgages on 70% of the homes were in default and owned by FHA, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. And I said to my staff was saying, look, we want to do aggressive servicing. I said, don't be ridiculous. There's nothing to service. Why don't we sell the mortgages to the town and let them reinvent the economy? So they said, well, we can't do that because they don't have any money. I said, don't be ridiculous. I'm from Wall Street. We buy everything. We never have any money. Have them create a trust or, you know, some kind of venture fund, depending on, you know, different state laws. It makes sense which one you do, how you do it. And we'll swap them the mortgages for stock in the trust or the venture fund. And they looked at me like I was nuts. I said, well, then the RTC came along during the 80s,
The Resolution Trust Corporation.
Resolution Trust Corporation cleanup. Yeah. And now securitization is much more common. So here's what I think. I think a community, and you could do it at a county level or out where you are smaller because you want to get down to a manageable group of people. If you literally approach the federal government and you said, look, we'll swap you equity for all the defaulted, not just the mortgages, but other assets in this place, because you've got student loans, you've got SBA loan, you know, you've got all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We'll swap you equity for all these assets, and by the way, it's going to be non-voting equity. You're going to be a non-voting partner. And we'll take charge of making this neighborhood wonderful again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you do that, you can combine that at a local level with all sorts of things to add equity. But here's what happens. If you look at the current financial system, Peter, people do not have, most people are investing their IRAs or 401ks or their savings into stocks, which are not place-based. So there's no financial incentive to heal the environment or to build up education, because these are the things that make place-based equity have a great deal of value. If you look at the stock market, a lot of companies are making money from doing something or from the government doing something that hurts places. But if we can create equity vehicles for our counties or our places, then we have a financial incentive to reduce consumption, to heal the environment, and do all sorts of things to build up human and intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to make a call, we'll call it a Collins Trust. If we're going to do a Collins, where do you live?
I live in California, near San Francisco.
But okay, well, one of my companies is in Pleasanton.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm in Marin County, is where I live, near where you'll be appearing.
Okay, well, this is perfect. You know, we should do this when I come out there. Marin County is the perfect kind of place. They don't have many foreclosures, is my guess. Not as many as Detroit.
Right. It's not nearly as bad. Modesto and Stockton are the worst in the region here.
Right.
In Sacramento.
But Marin certainly has equity capital, you know, that could be invested in facilitating some of these, because the goal is you buy in when things aren't working, you turn it around, and part of that is turning around the government money. When I was in the Bush administration, I tried to persuade them to do something they'd done in the Reagan administration, which was create jumbo waivers. So, for example, you could say, okay, in this community, we want a jumbo waiver that says we can waive all the food safety rules as long as the sales are within the county.
Right.
Okay. So you create this incentive system where everybody, including the federal government, benefits from turning around the economy. And then you do it in a way where, in fact, it generates capital gains, and then we can afford to hire lobbyists who can beat back the other lobbyists.
Very interesting. Catherine.
Well, I'm delighted to give you complimentary tickets. If you come to Mill Valley, we can talk about it some more.
Okay. Well, I would love to show up and hear your presentation. Now, tell me what your thoughts are about the Occupy Wall Street group that has been building. It's now into almost its fourth week. And we've seen similar demonstrations pop up in almost 50 cities around the country. Now, in Washington, a group there got infiltrated by an editor of the American Spectator, who threw a scene at one of their protests at the Air and Space Museum, leading to a pepper spray incident that made the protesters look really bad. But here we have a guy, a graduate of the Andrew Breitbart School of Journalism, who infiltrated the crowd and acted as a provocateur. So I find it interesting that the media initially ignored the group on Wall Street, and it wasn't until cops overreacted and used pepper and other sprays there, maces, that it started to make news. But I regard this as a very healthy sign that average Americans have recognized that they've been screwed, and some of them aren't quite clear on what they see as the cause or as a solution, but they feel the need to do something. And I, for one, think that it's a good development, even if it took them a while.
Well, I think any time people express what they're feeling, it's a good thing, particularly if they do it in a positive way. And I see these as mostly, everything I've seen is pretty positive about how they're doing. One of the things, I just published an article, two articles, it's a series on student loans. And one of the things I point out, I used to sit on the board of Sallie Mae. And one of the board members after I left in 1994, was a board member of my company. And the people who stayed and privatized Sallie Mae were people that I worked, you know, some of them were people I worked with. And if you read the article, it's linked at the on my homepage. It's called William Diefendorfer, the Financial Hitman of Student Loan. One of the things I point out, because of my history on Sallie Mae and my history with Bill and his involvement in my company, what I know for a fact, beyond any shadow of a doubt, is that Bill Diefendorfer knew that incomes were going to go down a lot and expenses were going to go up and the middle class was going to get squeezed. All the work of my company with Community Wizard and we were doing community venture funds was how do we help the American workforce transition and how do we do it in a way which makes money for the pension funds. That was our whole sort of mission in life. And so Bill knew that these kids would never be able to afford the student debt, the student loan debt. And, Peter, that's fraudulent inducement. I mean, these kids have been encouraged to take out huge amounts of loans and debt, not knowing, remember, they didn't know that incomes were going to go down. But the people sitting on that board did, certainly Bill Diefendorfer. I mean, I have a great deal of personal experience with him, you know, exploring and understanding those issues. So this is as ugly as it gets in terms of financial fraud, because you're talking about a group of very successful, wealthy, older people making a fortune, bankrupting kids, and changing the provision so that those kids cannot get out of that debt with bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is as ugly as it gets, and I'll tell you why. I've seen mortgage fraud used to do a beatdown on a neighborhood or do a beatdown on a group of people. But literally, this is a beatdown on the future because your economic success and my economic success depends on the next generation coming up.
Hey, my Social Security payments in a few years depend on those people.
Right. So when you destroy the ability of the young people to innovate and grow and build economic equity, you're destroying the future itself. And this is the they used to call me the cleaning lady of financial fraud when I was in Washington. So I thought I'd seen the worst. This is the worst. So if you look at what's been done to the kids, it's absolutely horrible. And, you know, if you read, I've been on the different websites reading story after story. If you read their story, they realize that they've basically been trapped, that they've been, you know, they've been targeted by a predatory force. And whether it's health care, whether it's the quality of the food and health, or the student loans, they see it. Now, what I've been waiting for is real solutions to emerge. There was a group out in Berkeley, at Berkeley College, who did this on Let's Move the Money. If all the kids on Occupy Wall Street just said, hey, pull all your money out of the big banks and shift it to the small community banks and credit unions, woohoo! You know, that would be wonderful.
But it seems that, I'm hearing from some people, for example, who are moving their money from a bank to, say, a credit union because of the reaction to Dodd-Frank, where the banks are trying to punish their customers by charging them a $5 or more monthly fee for using their debit cards. And it was a comedian who stated this most clearly, Will Durst, at least for me, that they're charging me for access to my money. This is not a loan. This is not, you know, this is money that I put into their bank that they're getting interest off on the float. They're paying me almost zero interest for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are charging me hard cash for saving them money because I could withdraw that money from my account using a paper check, which costs them much more and they lose some float time. But when I use my debit card to do a $50 fill-up at the gas station, that money is deducted from my account in seconds. And so this whole thing is just sideways. And it's that minor $5 charge that is getting some people amped up to move their money. But it doesn't seem to be the big picture that is motivating people to take individual action.
Well, if everyone in America voted with their time, their money, and their attention for the honest guys and pulled it from the dishonest guys, you can't imagine how this would change in a twinkling of an eye. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes me want to cry is I'll look a crowd at a video of Occupy Wall Street, and what I'll see is lots of kids who probably have Citibank and Chase credit cards in their back pocket. Now, when I was in Wall Street in Washington, as long as they had Citibank credit cards in their back pocket, you know, nobody cared if they walked up and down and screamed. If they suddenly said, okay, you know, let's tear up our Citibank and Chase credit cards, let's go to the local bank or the community or the credit union, and let's start voting with our money and our attention and our time, and we don't want to work for you either, that, you know, that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, so now, I would love to see the let's shift our money come out of it, but it hasn't yet.
Catherine, next I want to turn to a piece that I read online that you wrote some time back about John Perkins. And John Perkins has published several books explaining his role as an alleged economic hitman. And as he tells the story, he was dispatched to troubled countries that had economic problems, and his job was to further destabilize them by setting traps entrapping people into embarrassing situations or crimes so that they would lose their position. And as he described it, the ultimate goal was to break down unions, to force foreign investment to be permitted. And it kind of dovetails with Naomi Klein's shock doctrine about the way the Chicago school would be brought in to manipulate economies to make them friendlier to American investment and control. But you describe John Perkins' disclosures as limited hangout, the Richard Nixon reference. Take a moment here to explain why.
Sure. When that book was published, it got incredible attention. And I really wrote the story in response to not just what I read in the book, but sort of the reaction to it. One was, I think he does a very entertaining job of sort of describing an economic hitman and how the economic hitman is backed up with an assassin.
And he comes off as a charming, dashing rogue.
Well, I think he comes off as charming, but the thing, if you looked at Klein or Pallas, they've done a great job of documenting all of this stuff, but it's something about someone saying it at an intimate level, I did it, that seems to resonate, I think. You know, it makes it, in many respects, much more entertaining.
True.
Mm-hmm. So my concern, there's a point at the book, and I'm not looking at it, and I'm doing this from memory, but there's a point at the book where he basically implies that this is a bunch of intelligence agencies who got out of hand, and it's really not coming from the top. In other words, he kind of protects, there is no greater conspiracy. Well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I mean, these policies come very much from the top. They are, you know, you bring in drugs, you get all the hardworking people sort of, you know, desperately getting their kids out of prison, and then you come in using their money, you take it. You know, it's a leverage buyout of a place.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are very much engineered, and they're coordinated. The covert actions are coordinated with the overt actions, and it comes from the highest levels. There's a great thing. If you want to understand the American economy as of 1980, and I think Perkins wrote in the 70s, the way to do it, just shut all your blinds, turn off your phone, Peter, and watch Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Godfather 3 straight in a row, and understand you're not having an outstanding cinematic experience. You're getting a training program on how the American economy works.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great scene in Godfather 3 where Michael has this fantasy, Michael Corleone,
right,
that he's going to rise out of the street level and at some point go legit.
Yeah.
And he blows up and he says, the higher I go, the dirtier it gets. And that, you know, God love, you know, who made it? Was
well,
it's a wine company now.
Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, Coppola. God bless Coppola. You know, Godfather 3 did more to teach the American people about how the economy works than just about any movie ever. But there's a place where Perkins just kind of does a cop-out. Now, I'm assuming he did the cop-out because he wanted to be safe. No, but it was a terrible cop-out. And, you know, I have a used to have a pastor in Washington who say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And people need to get over this, you know, they really need to understand this is really happening, and it's coming from the top. And if we can see it as it is, there are many solutions, but there are no solutions until we see it. So that was number one. The second thing was there was an implication, not so much from anything he said direct on, but from the way the book was used and took it, that this is only happening in emerging markets far, far away. Well, that's ridiculous. It's happening in every county in America. You know, the economic hit and the assassin are here, and they've been here for decades. And so, you know, this is a global model, and it's very dangerous when we just say, oh, this is terrible, it's happening in the emerging markets, we need to stop it. No, it's happening to your neighbor right now, and you need to deal with it, because it's somebody in your family is helping to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the narcotics trafficking and the mortgage fraud, this is not 20 guys from Wall Street or Washington are doing it. This is our neighbors. And you know, this is our family. This is us. We're doing this. It's and there's a kind of disassociation and inability to look at the fraud and the corruption here in America at an intimate level. And it's when we look at it that we start to have real power, that we can really shift things.
Well, and I just watched Ken Burns' series on Prohibition on PBS. And and I think that drives your point, Catherine, that we view organized crime and syndicates of fraud as quaint artifacts from the past.
Right.
And yet we have been robbed blind. Pick your time period, but the last 10 years it's been most extreme. And still many Americans are sitting there either bewildered or just kind of at a loss to figure out how this happened and what they ought to do about it.
Well, it's pretty simple. And the funny thing is, if you look at the train tracks of fascism, they grew up in this country on illegal drugs. Well, prohibition turned into illegal drugs and mortgage fraud. And this, you know, if you look at the mortgage frauds, I grew up at 48th and Larchwood in West Philadelphia, a block away from Chubby Checker's mother. Are you too young to remember Chubby Checker?
I am not. I know how to do the twist, and
right.
I remember Let's Twist Again,
uh-huh,
like we did last summer.
All right. Well, I grew up in West Philadelphia, and my neighborhood, the equity in our real estate was wiped out by the fundamental single-family fraud that was just the most expensive fraud you just saw, you know, in the last 3, 4, or 5 years. So, you know, this has been going on for decades. And if you dig down in any neighborhood or any county, because the funny thing about this model, Peter, is it's so centralized. And I didn't believe this when I started to try and sort of figure out. I was in Washington. I left Washington in 99. I said, okay, I'm going to see how this works at a county level. Well, there's nothing more dangerous than drilling down and finding out how mortgage fraud and drug dealings really works at your county level.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I discovered it is, you know, to talk about this in TV terms, Tony Soprano is running the drug and mortgage business, and his profits are financing James Bond and the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and if you get into the history of the black budget and secret technology projects, you know, it's all connected, and they can't afford for one neighborhood to leave the model, because then all the other neighborhoods might want to leave. So it's remarkably, you know, top down and centralized, but it's very, very strong, because with a financial system this leveraged, we're leveraged by stocks and then debt and then derivatives. You know, if you take a county where you're generating 4 million profits in drugs, you're laundering it through fast food restaurants that are publicly traded, who are trading at a multiple of 10 times earning, that's 40 million stock value. You lever that with bonds and derivatives, you're talking about $100 million, you know, that can get wiped out if the kids stop dealing cocaine.
Yeah. Very interesting. And also, if we were able to overnight end the drug trade in Mexico, the government would collapse.
Well, it's funny. I'll tell you my favorite story. I was never have an epiphany when you're giving a speech, Peter. I was in Philadelphia, and I was speaking to a group of people called Spiritual Frontiers Foundation, and they have a conference once a year to talk about how to help our society evolve spiritually. So I'm in the middle of the speech, and it later became an article called Narco Dollars for Beginners, and it's really designed to help you understand the relationship between government and organized crime in sort of a funny way, because it's depressing. Nobody, you know. So this is supposed to be light and funny. And I'm in the middle of the speech, and I was describing the hearings in Congress related to the Gary Webb Dark Alliance allegations of government drug dealing in South Central L.A. And at the time, a reporter had been told by a spokesperson for the Department of Justice that the U.S. financial system launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year. So that was in 1997. So I said to this wonderful group of people who, you know, are spiritually evolved and were there to help our society spiritually, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in money laundering? And they said, well, you know, we would offend the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year and the accumulated capital thereon. And I said, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern, and if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your neighborhood, your county, your state, your country tomorrow. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, guess how many would push the button?
Probably none.
One. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? They said, we don't want our mutual funds to go down. We don't want our government checks to stop, and we don't want our taxes to go up. And what I discovered that day, interestingly enough, was the problem was not that they wouldn't push the red button. The problem was they were so scared to talk about it that we couldn't have a we needed to have a conversation about how do we turn it green. In other words, how do we make money pushing the red button? So if every county in California created a Collins Trust like we were talking about earlier,
yeah,
they could make money from pushing the red button because the stocks would go up. So, you know, so there are solutions, but it requires having a really honest conversation about what's going on. And that, for many people, that's dangerous and uncomfortable.
And so, Catherine, I want you to know that Office Depot has supplied me with a red button here.
That was easy.
And it, when I press the button, it says this.
That was easy.
I wish it were that easy.
I wish it were, too.
Catherine Austin Fitz, one place where your name has surfaced repeatedly is in various works related to the 9/11 truth movement. And I count myself among the members of it. I always I always like to define that my position is I don't reach a conclusion. I don't know that, for example, it was, quote-unquote, an inside job. But I know that the official narrative is bullshit, and I know that the work of the 9/11 Commission was a massive cover-up, and I went to Washington at my own expense and spent time watching the proceedings and came away confirming the whitewash and appalled at the way the families, the survivors of those who died on 9/11, were manipulated and often ignored. You have approached this from your frame, looking at the economic and business analysis of what occurred. Tell me what your current thinking is about 9/11 and the way the Obama administration has extended the cover-up put in place by Bush.
Well, I think my frame is that we are centralizing the economy. We've gone through unprecedented centralization of capital and centralization of economic and political power. And 9/11 did more to encourage that centralization, sort of both to consolidate the centralization up until then to basically wipe clean a lot of the documentation and evidence and investigations on fraud up to that point. So, you know, it really helped the fraudsters get away with the money.
And so let me just shorthand. The day before 9/11, Rumsfeld released a report about billions missing from the
trillions.
Pentagon.
No, trillions.
Trillions, thank you.
There are $4 trillion that we have documented missing from the federal government, and $3.4 trillion of that is from DOD, from the Pentagon.
Okay. And the other financial issues relate to people who have exploited the events for the military expansion and many of the other, the domestic crackdown, the police state that's been created, the money that pours out to local law enforcement agencies from the new Homeland Security Department, all that.
Right. I call the Patriot Act the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act. Because, listen, an economy runs based on rules. Okay? So, let's say you and I create a company, and that company has a charter, and it has bylaws, and it's subject to all sorts of corporate laws. That law those rules, those contracts, are the basis of what it is. Okay?
Right.
And so any type of economy, you know, is very much grounded in both the laws and who enforces the law and who has to obey the law and who doesn't. And we've now created societies where we have one group which is completely outside the law or above the law, and another group that is having to obey more and more and more laws. And that's not, it's not an accident that the first one is getting richer and richer at the expense of the second.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I think 9/11 was very significant, whether it was the military expansion, whether it was the control and concentration of cash flow, and the additional sort of I have a whole series of articles on 9/11 which you can find if you either do a search. I will tell you the most popular 9/11 story I wrote, interestingly enough, was not so much on money. When Condoleezza Rice testified, I was watching the Jersey Girls. One of the Jersey Girls responded, and they were speaking like me after my lawyers beat up. You know, you talk in pretzel talk, and no one can understand what you're saying because your lawyer is just, you know, has just warned you what you can and cannot say. So I thought, okay, well, somebody has to do this. So I wrote a letter to Condoleezza Rice basically saying she's a liar and mm-hmm. giving four reasons why.
Yeah.
Peter, I was poisoned a couple days later. I mean, it was really bad.
Really?
Yeah, no, it was really bad.
Food poisoning or what?
I don't know. I know what happened. I know what the doctors have said. I know what came out the other side. We've done many, many tests trying to figure out what it was, and finally we just... And it was funny. I called... I had a friend who worked in covert operations with the Department of Justice, and I called him, and I said, look, I just need to know what it is. I just need to get it out. So, you know, no hard feelings. Just let me know what it was because I want to get it out. And he came back, and, you know, I won't say the name of the company, but there was a company that used to do a lot of personal services work for Dick Cheney. And he came back and said, we don't think it wasn't us. We think it was those guys.
Oh. Huh.
But that.
Well, I'm glad you can laugh about it, but... you know, it's so amazing how they have been able to lock out any serious questioning of 9/11, and I don't need to go through the litany for you.
I don't think they've succeeded at all, because I think, you know what changed the whole pH on 9/11?
Yeah.
Was YouTube. I have a wonderful roommate who I went to the University of Pennsylvania with. We used to bartend together. This is a wonderful woman, Peter, but she does not read anything other than People magazine and romance novels
mm-hmm.
her whole life. And a couple years ago, I'm driving down the highway, and she calls. The phone rings. I hadn't talked to her about a year. And she said, Fitz, 9/11 was an inside job. I said, was that in People magazine? And she said, have you seen Loose Change? And, you know, something's happened because of the YouTube and the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful because, I think if we were to take an honest poll, to the extent that 9/11 truthers have done polls in New York, it's quite amazing. I've seen this shift. I live in a neighborhood where it was very funny because right after 9/11, all the white folks thought it was the Muslims and all the black folks thought it was the Bushes. And, you know, there was a complete split in perception of what was really going on, and it was remarkable to watch. But then over time, you know, you really began to see people say, well, the story doesn't make sense. And this information doesn't make sense, and something's wrong. You know, and their kids are getting killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you're starting to see people realize that things are not as they seem, but they don't want to talk about it because they don't know what to do. And that's why it's so important to talk about what can we do.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do? Because I've been tilting at this for quite a while, and the most recent opening is provided by Ali Soufan and Richard Clark and others who are now corroborating that
right.
the CIA failed to share critical intelligence about the presence in the country of two individuals who became 9/11 hijackers and who...
That's a remarkable videotape of Richard Clark in that interview.
It
remarkable.
Is. And I have helped expose the identity of the CIA operative who was at the center of that cover-up and later bragged about being present at the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah. Her name is Bukowski, and the CIA threatened the producers who recorded that interview with Richard Clark, Novoselsky and Duffy, and tried to prevent them from disclosing her name. So Sibel Edmonds and I found, through open source methods, information about this woman, and we put it out there publicly. And hopefully people will understand that it was individuals who were at the center of this. There were more than 60 people at the CIA named in a secret investigative report from the Inspector General. And I was able to confirm with Joby Warwick of the Washington Post that he's seen that list and that the Post has not attempted to really challenge the government's efforts to prevent them from publishing it.
Here's the challenge that the government has. The government is managing, the federal government is not, you know, a lot of people in America talk about the government as though it was one place. It's not. It's many different agencies. There's lots of factions. It's very murky. But what it is the richest financial mechanism ever created in the history of this planet that I know of. And what you've got is you've got a central bank that prints money and a treasury that prints bonds, and then they force people and countries all around the world to take that paper and those bonds in exchange for cheap natural resources and labor. And the reason that everybody around the world goes along with it is because we control the sea lanes, we control the satellites, and we've got the biggest nuclear arsenal. So the value of the dollar and our ability to sell treasury bills depends on force. And one of the reasons that you're seeing the force get greater and greater and greater is the more the more unproductive the system gets and the more uneconomic it gets, the more force it takes to make it go and the less risk everybody at the top can handle. And so they want more and more power and more control. And literally one of the one of the questions around pushing the red button or turning it green is how do we stop literally, because we have a tapeworm, and that tapeworm is parasiting the host, and the host is getting weaker and weaker and angrier, and the tapeworm is getting stronger and stronger and more forceful. And that's exactly the spiral we're in, and that's the spiral, the part of the spiral where there are more and more rules and more violence and more military. We're going to the Middle East because we want to control the natural resources and the bank deposits. I mean, it's this is a war for market share. This is the economic hit.
Well, it's fascinating when you follow the money.
Yep.
Catherine, give us a preview. You're coming to Mill Valley, where you'll be appearing at the Community Center on October 27th at 7 p.m. That's a Thursday evening. Give us a preview of what you'll present and how the evening will go.
Sure. It's called the talk is called Investment Strategies for Changing Times, and I'm going to give a presentation for about an hour, and then we're going to have questions and answers for about an hour. And it's always a very lively conversation. Mill Valley. I was there, Peter, in 2004, basically advising. Okay, you're an individual, you're a family. The world is what it is. What do you do to protect your assets from? I said there's a tapeworm. Well, the tapeworm is trying to eat and debase your assets. So how do you protect it? So I'm going to go back and say, here's what I told you in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was there in 2008. So I have a track record. And now I'm going to say, okay, what did I say in 2004? What did I say in 2008? Okay, what's happening now? And what does that, let's refresh and update. What do you do today? And so it's very much from the individual or family's point of view. Because my idea of starving the tapeworm is everybody prevent the tapeworm from stealing or debasing their money.
Mm-hmm. And in simple terms, do you move to cash, gold, and other commodities?
I recommended precious metals in 2004 and 2008, and I do again, but I think it's part of a balanced. I don't think precious metals are a magic bullet, and I also think they're very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I'm going to focus on are what are the primary trends. At the end of the day, yes, we have the military force to force and price the dollar at a certain thing, but ultimately fundamental economics count. So I want to look at what are the primary trends, and one of the primary trends, of course, is real things versus paper. And that's why precious, if you look at the value of precious metals, it hasn't gone up. Fiat currency has gone down. An ounce of gold is still an ounce of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about this trend of from paper to real things. That's one of the primary trends. Another primary trend I'm going to talk about is this idea of force setting prices and how do you manage through that. So how do you think about the dollar and use that and protect yourself from sort of the force economy and the tapeworm.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I'm going to talk about is the emerging markets, because to a certain extent, if you really step back and look at the whole planet, we're moving capital from the places where the populations are aging to the places where the population is young. And so the reality needs to be the young places are going to grow much more than the aging population. So we're going to look at the emerging markets and what that's all about. And then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about new technology. A lot of our economy is determined not by new technology, but by the suppression of new technology. And, of course, one of the big wild cards over the next 10 to 20 years is, are they going to let that technology out of the closet?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk a little bit about zero-point energy and some of the other things that, if they come out of the closet, could rapidly change the economics as we know them.
Well, you've piqued my interest, Catherine, and I want to be there.
Complimentary tickets, Peter, for you and a guest.
Okay. And how do my listeners get a ticket or sign up to attend?
If you go to Solari.com, you can buy tickets through our website. Just go to the homepage. There's a graphic both on the homepage and at the blog, or just come. I'm sure we'll have tickets at the door.
Okay. Solari, Solari.com. Catherine Austin Fitz, a pleasure to meet you, and I'll meet you in person later this month.
You're as wonderful as everyone says you are, Peter. Thank you.
Good to talk with you today. From Tennessee to the California coast and any place far and wide, I'm glad you're listening. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.